5K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Let's see now. I gotta figure out where the sound is coming out of here. Okay, sounded. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we do most Sunday evenings for the last 34 or so years. You guys already know the main reason for the TechNet is to pass information back and forth. People who want to be a little bit more educated as to how wireless equipment works. So the curious people gather here and teach each other. You sign into the TechNet by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a comment or a question for the net. So, for those who want to sign in, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RI, if you're listening.
W2OAY, Joe, yes.
Okay. You said that WA2 so fast, it sounded like W2. K2RI, gotcha, Joe. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Give me a call letter as a name right now. One more call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me a call letter as a name right now.
B2J.
Yeah.
Richardson, yes.
Okay, we heard Eric and a double. Somebody named Rich. Rich, give me your call letters, please.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike.
Okay, Golf X-Ray Mike, we got you, Rich. And so far, we've got Joe, Eric, and Rich. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. One last call for somebody to check into the TechNet. Give me a call letters and name. Okay, we heard nothing, so we'll start up with Joe. The B2RYY, K2RJW. You got it, Joe.
My paper here. I just had some. Give me about 30 seconds, alright? I'll be right back to you.
We'll be standing by.
Yeah, let the next guy go. Wait a minute. I gotta have. Okay, here we go. Alright, this has to do with propagational band openings. Very recently I had in two different directions able to get some good TV reception. Give me the first one. The first one's up in the direction of Albany, where normally these channels don't come in at all in the New York area. It was RF channel 6, RF 7, and RF 26. They can be quite viewable for, you know, a length of time. Here's the funny part. RF-13, which is also located at the same transmitter location, couldn't get that one at all. Now, even though RF Channel 7 in New York is there, and it's on high band, RF-13 also is in New York, but I couldn't get that from Albany. Now, I'll give you the same example for what I noticed from Boston. Hang on a minute. I got three channels in Boston, RF-30, RF-19, RF-31. They were able to be viewable. RF-30 is co-located in New York, or co-channel New York. Pretty strong carrier out here, but in Boston. I was able to see RF-30, which is DT-4 from Boston. RF-19 came in, RF-31 came in. Here's the channels that didn't come in, 43, 42, 41, 32, and 39. Couldn't see stuff on those channels. So here's my question. How come you get propagation on some frequencies and you really don't get it on others? They're all coming from the same transmitter location. That's a little bit of a stumper.
Well, different channels are on different frequencies, as I see it, Joe. Therefore, they've got different wavelengths, and therefore, the multipath that we're going to get is going to have different phasing characteristics. So depending on where the multipath is coming from, and what wavelength you're on, your receiving antenna is either in a null, a peak, or something in between. That's one possible guess. The multipath is putting you in a null or a peak. Now, it's like a standing wave in space, if you know what I mean. So you've got peaks and valleys at various frequencies because of the difference in wavelength. That's the best guess I can make. On top of that, some of the channels that you don't get, is your definition of don't get means that when you use your service monitor as a spectrum analyzer, you see no energy there, or you do see energy, but because there's co-channel interference or inter-symbol distortion, your converter says, I give up, there's nothing there that I can decode. So when you don't get, does that mean you're not getting demodulation, or you're not getting energy on your spectrum analyzer? W2RYY, K2RIW, and stick that.
In this case, I was using just the TV converter as a monitor. I did not have a spectrum analyzer hooked up to actually measure. I look at RF signal strength, and I could measure any kind of distortion, whether it just tells you something's there or something's not. But, okay, so you think it's just simply because of different wavelengths, you get different multipaths, it's just not, simply not going to come in. That could be it. And here's a funny one with the TV antenna I have, which is an HD 8200U made by Weingard. I don't recall the exact front-to-back ratio, but somewhere around 14-15 dB.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They're actually 2 degrees for me. Excuse me, 234 for me. And I can turn the antenna 180 degrees, and I can still get them off the back of the antenna. And in that case, I did use a spectrum analyzer and noticed that the difference between front to back was a lot less, making me wonder that if you're getting any of this kind of ducting, is it really coming from the horizon or more coming from over, you know, partially overhead? Because the antenna would lose its directivity. If something was approaching from like, almost like maybe a top of it or a 45 degree angle. What do you think about that? W2RYY.
On that last transmission, you didn't wait for the four beeps, Eric, Joe. Therefore, we lost about 30 seconds of your conversation until the machine got reset. No matter how much band opening you get, the real signal is being propagated by some kind of a tropospheric ducting-like effect. The troposphere only exists between 0 and 6 miles above the surface of the Earth. There is nothing VHF-wise more than 6 miles high that's going to give you a signal. Oh, once in a blue moon at low VHF frequencies, yes, you do get a sporadic E or kind of a ionospheric skip, but that's rare. As far as the UHF channels that you're watching most of the time, that signal has to be coming within the first 6 miles of the atmosphere. And since the signal you're watching is 20 miles, 40 miles, a couple hundred miles away, for all practical purposes, that signal is coming from the horizon, within a couple of degrees of the horizon. There's no way that signal can come at you at a 45 degree elevation angle. There's nothing at a 45 degree elevation angle that's going to give you that signal on a UHF frequency coming into your antenna. So the change in what you think is front-to-back ratio could be because you're reflecting off other objects in the environment. Even if the antenna has a very good front-to-back ratio, if in the back of your antenna there's a water tower or a building, you're getting an echo from it. Now when you turn the antenna in that direction, you're going to think you have a poor front-to-back ratio. So those are some of my thoughts on that subject. You see why I believe that your signal almost always comes to you within a couple of degrees of the horizon. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Yes, I understand about the same propagation, but I was thinking of more in a, you know, a simplicity type of, thinking, where if it's coming through some sort of channel that's above the Earth, maybe 1,000 feet up, maybe less than that, maybe 2,000 feet up, where we get different layers of air because of water moisture, have different characteristics that make it stand like waveguide. What would happen if the signal is not actually coming to the horizon, but actually coming more ahead, because where it leaves the atmosphere or there's an opening or change is more overhead to where your location is compared to you looking at the horizon? Would that account for something like that possibly? Well, you don't think the propagation actually works like that.
Yeah, interesting question. And the guys who operate on 10 gigs see the effect you're talking about. The individual droplets of water in a cloud are starting to approach a couple of percent of the wavelength at 10 gigahertz. So therefore, the individual water droplets are reflecting objects. So rain cloud scatter on 10 gigs really does exist. There's something called Rayleigh scattering. As the droplet size during the reflecting gets smaller, the amount of echo you get off of it goes down by a square law. So by the time you get down to VHF frequencies, your water droplets are so small, the radar cross section is so small, the densest cloud you can think of, a couple of miles above your house, maybe a mile or two ahead of your house, you know, in the direction where the transmitting station is located. So you think you've got a 45-degree angle between your antenna and that cloud, and you think you're going to get a VHF/UHF reflection off that cloud. You study the radar cross-section of clouds at UHF frequencies, it's amazingly small. I won't say it's zero, but it's so close to zero. It goes up real fast as you go up in frequency. At 10 gigs, you're starting to get some real echo off the cloud. The individual water droplets will give you rain scatter. And the rain scatter, when you hear it, because the individual water droplets are moving, some of them moving toward you, some of them moving away from you, because the rain cloud has got counterclockwise rotation. It's usually a low pressure area, and therefore the droplets that are to the left of the path are coming toward you. The droplets to the right of the path are moving away from you. You get
repeater. Time out.
You're getting differential Doppler shift, and so therefore you hear an aurora-like sound. You know what? On 6 meters, and you're listening to an aurora echo, it's got a characteristic sound to it that you start hearing on cloud reflection, rain cloud reflection, on 10 gigs. But at the UHF frequencies, now, there's essentially no way that a cloud can give you a significant radar cross-section and a real echo. The sporadic cloud, it's midway between you and Ohio. You get a band opening on, say, 6 meters and 2 meters. That's a very dense cloud. It's spread out as a sheet of material, and you're looking at it as an extremely narrow grazing angle, very similar to what happens when you look at a grazing angle of the glass on the front store of a store window. At a very shallow grazing angle, you start seeing an echo, you start seeing mirror image off of that glass, but straight on, not at all. So a sporadic E-cloud, you're getting an echo from it at VHF frequencies, but only at extremely sharp, extremely narrow grazing angle. To get a 45-degree bounce off of a cloud, by rain scatter on 10 gigs, yes. On UHF frequencies, I think there is no mechanism that can do that, Joe. To BQRYY, KQRIW.
Okay, I just thought the whole subject was interesting to bring up, possibly maybe somebody else has heard something about it, but, perhaps not. It was just an interesting observation I made.
In your case, where your definition of getting the signal and not getting the signal, whether or not your converter was responding, in many cases your converter is seeing co-channel interference, or multipath with intersymbol distortion. In either case, it's saying, I don't have a coherent signal there that I can demodulate, so I'm going to give you nothing. Or I'll give you a sign across the screen that says weak signal. That really means high bid error rate. Doesn't mean necessarily the signal is weak. It would have been interesting to see with your spectrum analyzer whether or not there really was energy there on those particular channels that you thought were missing. Keep up the good work, Joe. And I saw a report recently where lots of guys used to use the high power signals, the carrier signal, the Cominance carrier signal, 3.57945 megahertz. They would use it as a beacon on broadcast stations scattered around the United States to look for band openings in those areas. Well, now that we got digital television, and the thing that you look for, the little bit of carrier at the low end, it's a darn weak that they're no longer using that. Let me drop this. So these guys that used to use television, AM amplitude modulated old-fashioned television as beacons, have now switched over to using the 19 kilohertz pilot tone of FM broadcast transmitters. They're using that now as beacons. So the next high power signals that they can depend on scattered around the United States broadcast wise are FM broadcast, 88 to 108 megacycles. And I guess they didn't use those in the past because the television channels went to higher and lower frequencies that gave them more information. Now they're only getting beacons on that one band, 88 to 108 megs. But at least they are getting beacons. So imagine you're involved with some of the FM broadcast channels also, as well as television in the New York City area, Eric. So I guess you're probably aware that that 19 kilohertz subcarrier for stereo reception, that people are using that as a beacon. K2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ.
Actually, I've heard of a number of guys now using 56 kilohertz where the RDS is, which actually you can decode pretty simply and get the actual call sign and station. I've heard of a number of folks, especially in California, doing that. I do have a comment in terms of reception. When the World Trade Center was still up, I had the need to monitor what was coming out of the transmitter at the station's location at 38th Street. And I went through a whole series of different antennas to try and create the best possible reception concept, especially in the summer months, especially high VHF, where there is a lot of co-channel. Let me let it drop. In the air, but don't forget, I'm looking at the World Trade Center. I've got an antenna that's, well, let's see. I guess it's about 350 feet in the air. The building was like, the top of the building was, I think, 290. And then we had a tower on the top of the building to mount stuff on, because we also had microwaves and a few other things going. What I eventually wound up with, this huge single channel 18 antenna that was humongous, but I did manage to kill all the co-channel that kept coming in. So there are ways when, you know, especially if I go back and think about the time that I spent at doing cable TV around the corner from you. Do you remember those antenna structures? Those were all single channel antennas, and we actually used to make the measurements of what co-channel was coming in where, because there was the time of day that you could actually determine based on the offset. K2RIW, K2J.
The 56 kilohertz RDS you talked about, what does RDS stand for, Eric?
Okay, in Europe it's called RDS. Here we call it RDS. It's a radio display system. When you turn on the FM radio in your car, and you'll see the station call sign and what's playing. That's really 9600 baud that's modulated at 56 kilohertz.
Did you say 96 baud?
It's a serial stream.
Radio display system, interesting. When you get in co-channel interference, if you're willing to mount, you know this, but I'm mentioning to other people, mount a pair of antennas side by side, maybe one of them sits slightly ahead of the other, and you're combining the signals between the two with a power divider, power summer. When you set it up just right, the desired signal is in phase on the two antennas. The undesired signal, that is, let's say 5, 10, 15 degrees off to one side, is out of phase. You're building an interferometer. You're making a whole bunch of fingers in space as far as the antenna pattern is concerned. And if you can steer a null in the direction of the guy that gives you co-channel interference, you can get rid of him. And therefore, a lot of cable TV front-end systems in the old days used to use that. You had single-channel antennas on Vanderbilt Parkway at the cable TV front end with Mr. Jim Nishimura, I think it was, which is essentially my next-door neighbor.
He passed away 3 years ago.
So he's a silent key. Was he ever a ham radio operator, out of curiosity?
No, he was not. He was one of the first people that were involved with a company called Gerald that became General Instruments. And they and a small group of people had put together the first cable system in Harrisburg. He was also a member of the class that Charlie Dolan's came out of, so. They were buddies at one point, but then fierce competitors later on.
I vaguely remember you told us that periodically you spent some number of hours per year plugging cassettes into a machine at Vanderbilt Parkway in order to install certain movies onto the cable channel so that people in the, the northern Huntington area could watch that particular movie. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead, KQLIW.
No, I only filled in when the other people that were supposed to be doing it weren't around. You're talking early 70s and, three-quarter-inch tape machines and HBO and Showtime. Actually, Showtime was around at that point, but there was no MTV, there was no HBO. That just didn't come around until 1980.
Too bad there wasn't an automatic machine that could plug in those cassettes. Nowadays, all of that material would be put on a couple of hard drives, and the computer program would switch over to the right hard drive at the right time. Is that about the way it would be done these days, Eric?
Well, we started doing that more than 20 years ago. I think it was like 25 years ago, one of the first automatic systems came around. Well, actually, in the days that back then, the way we switched what channels were on what channels, all the modulators and the head-end devices all had IF out at 45 megahertz, and there was really a mechanical drum with little pins in it that would spin around and make the choices as to which modulator got connected to which receiver or which video modulator. So, I mean, automation's been around from very early. It started out as being very mechanical, but today, one little system, which may be 6 rack units high, will handle 1,000 customers and have the whole slew of movies for multiple channels. So it's an entirely different world, but yeah.
When you say handle 1,000 customers, does that mean each one can have his own starting time on a pay-per-view movie? Over you, Eric.
That's correct. Actually, the satellite providers didn't really catch up to that until a bunch of years back when they started putting telephone modems into their receivers. And typically, like on DirecTV or EchoStar, which you know is Dish Network, when you do a pay-per-view movie, it will actually start downloading through the phone line. If you're lucky enough to have an internet connection, it'll go that way too. So at least that's the way it works today. Yeah, but in the old days, we did have the ability to feed you a type of view that you yourself could watch, but as far as cable systems are concerned, the box that has 1,000 subscribers, each one gets their own start time as soon as the buffer fills up enough to start playing the movie while the rest of it catches up.
In the early 70s, that cable system front end that was one door away from my house, when it was in full operation, it was supplying those customers, potentially, if they're willing to pay for the whole service. What's the number of channels of information it was supplying is question number one. Question number two, how many of those channels were arriving at the front end by over-the-air broadcast reception, either from New York or New Jersey or Connecticut? So, how many channels were coming out of there, and where was most of the inputs of those channels, and and what was the name of the system? Did he have to pay a premium to those broadcast channels that he was rebroadcasting? I would guess not. I would guess the New York City channels were happy to have more customers of both their ads as well as their programming. Fill me in on some of that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. K2RIW, K2EJ. As I mentioned before, this was before the time of the big cable providers like CNN and HBO and stuff like that. In COMAC, there was United Artists Cable, and we actually had an AM STL that connected to them, and they had stuff that we would take. But for the most part, everything was over the air. We picked up channels from Connecticut and I think one from Rhode Island, and a bunch from New Jersey, and of course all of New York. And that's the way it started. As the other services came into being, eventually they started getting provided, but that took almost 10 years. And the distribution for most of that is through satellite.
So what was the name of that service, Eric, that Mr. Nishimura was providing, and you were part of his technical backup? How many years was it in operation? Over to you, Eric.
No, there was a name for it. I have to dig back into the wells of my mind, you know, but it's been so long, so I can't remember the trade name that they gave it. It was some kind of movie theater thing, you know, and I think they ran like 4 or 5 movies all simultaneously. And of course, they all had a real start time and a real ending time. As far as how long it lasted, don't forget, he actually went to the bank and took out loans to keep his service going because, even today, it's still expensive to put up a mile cable. Today, it's way more expensive. But as the Dolans came into being and as they got bigger and had more money, they essentially bought the Huntington Cable from the bank, and then it became part of their system.
Okay, you just said it. Was it called Huntington Cable TV?
Yeah, the service was called Huntington Cable TV, but you asked about the movies. There was a trade name for the movies. I can't remember what it was.
ACJS info?
You got it, Eric. Bill.
So I'm coming into the conversation late. I'm not sure if you guys related this piece of information already, but my understanding of the rules of rebroadcasting things on cable networks are that if you own an over-the-air broadcast television station, you are allowed to demand, essentially, that a local cable company carry your content, your channel. Or you can opt to attempt to charge them a fee, at which point the cable company can either pay the fee for the content or decide not to carry it. AC2IS.
That's not true.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Back in the early 70s, there was a, I'm trying to think of the guy's name, and it's not coming to me, but there was a battle between Manhattan Cable and Teleprompter. Teleprompter was the uptown part of Manhattan, and Manhattan Cable TV had the lower half of Manhattan. From all of that mishigas that happened around the country, there was a series of laws which actually the Congress is trying to mesh with them now along with the FCC, and it's called must carry. If you are going to go get yourself a cable franchise and you establish yourself, those that are in your grade A and even some of your grade B areas have to comply with the rule of must carry, meaning must carry the station. You can negotiate the price, whereas actually most, believe it or not, most TV stations will pay the cable company to provide the path to being able to provide the service. It's very weird, but a station does not have, a cable system does not have the option not to carry a station that's in must carry. There are other distance stations that you can negotiate a carriage package, but it's not required. That's the only place it's not required. K2RIW, K2J.
Eric, in these must carry situations where you negotiate a price, who pays who? Who is the payee? Who's the payee and who's the receiver of the dollars, Eric? Go ahead.
No, in the beginning, the must carry rules essentially say that the cable system must carry the broadcaster. How they get the broadcaster's signal is up to them. But the broadcaster can say, I'm going to provide you with a piece of fiber, and I want you to carry the best quality of my signal and not be subject to atmospheric disturbances. And in that case, the TV station pays for the path to the cable company. Now, as years went on, now you can negotiate what the TV station has to be paid for carriage of their services. So, I mean, the rules have changed somewhat. I mean, the rules are still the same in terms of what's carried, but who pays what? You will find that, for example, every now and then you'll see that negotiation broke down between Comcast and, say, CBS. And if they don't, you know, if CBS does not accept their offer, they, in essence, can demand that they don't carry their station until such time that some contract has been negotiated. And you'll see that on satellite more than typically on cable systems, but it happens.
Nowadays, does a broadcast station consider their material copyright, proprietary, personally owned, and therefore you have to pay them in order to take that material that they have created and reproduce it on your cable system? Over you, Eric.
Well, it used to be, even from the early 50s and 60s, when a station signed on or signed off, you'll see a notice saying that all the material coming from this station is copyright, cannot be retransmitted or reproduced by any means without express permission from the owner, the TV station. So that kind of answers your question.
And I think a number of the Long Island cable systems had a problem with Madison Square Garden not being able to negotiate a price to carry Madison Square Garden, and therefore the typical cable TV viewer was very unhappy that he wasn't getting the sporting events from Madison Square Garden. I know I've got some of this mixed up, but didn't that exist for a significant period of time fairly recently, Eric, K2RIW?
Now, if you're talking about Madison Square Garden Cablevision, that's many years ago, because what happened was they got so teed off that they actually went and bought Madison Square Garden. That became one of Cablevision's property, so that solved that problem. By the way, Madison Square Garden is not an over-the-air channel and is not subject to must carry. It's a pure negotiation.
Now, while we've got you here, Eric, we've been there's a pretty well-kept secret that's not very much in the news these days about the fact that our television system is about to go through a fairly significant change, and the television receiving equipment, if we're watching over-the-air television right now, an awful lot of it's about to become obsolete, and so we're going to need new TV sets, new converters, and right now they're proposing no new converters. What's the latest on that change? Is it on schedule? Are we going to start seeing some real change happening in, say, the next year and a half? And so, for those of us who watch over-the-air television, are we a year and a half away from buying new equipment to make sure we can continue to receive our favorite television channels, KE2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, there's been a lot of activity as far as the FCC, they're holding hearings and stuff like that. Just remember that ATSC 3, or the new system, is going to be marketplace driven, not commanded by the government or by the FCC. So this is going to be a marketplace thing. Although, there's a lot of mischief going on in terms of where and how. So that's kind of being determined at this point. But if you, say, have already filed for your license and things are kind of on hold as the auction begins to settle down, nobody has yet gotten paid for anything yet, although the people that bought the frequencies have already paid their dollars. And T-Mobile is trying to force a lot of stations to leave early. And there's a lot of stuff going on at the moment. You will probably see the first real ATSC 3 stations come on the air sometime in October, November, before the beginning of next year. But there'll be few and far between. Actually, there's one station now down in Washington that's transmitting in that format. The format itself is essentially, for all practical purposes, finished. The Koreans are actively on the air now with their brand of ATSC 3. And they've designed the receivers to be able to be upgraded to the latest and greatest in terms of the software, because the interactive stuff has finally been decided. And that hasn't been included in the Korean stuff at this point, but as the manufacturers gear up, and as the actual committee finalized.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You lost the last 8 or 10 seconds. So, beginning of next year seems to be when we're going to start seeing significant change in over-the-air broadcast. For a person who is watching cable television, Will he sense any change in format of ATS-3, or will the method by which he watches cable television essentially stay constant? What's going to happen in the next few years on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Okay, that's another area of contention. K2LIW, K2EJ. As far as the cable viewer is concerned, they don't receive ATS-V. They receive 32, 64 QAM. Even the weak channels would be like 16 QAM. It's all a matter of how they want to pack their cable. I mean, even though it's cable, still it's a limited amount of bandwidth, and the same thing is applied to fiber too. Actually, if you look at the fiber delivery systems, they're actually delivering RF over the fiber. There's a limit as to the not so much the emitters, but the detectors in terms of the bandwidth that they're capable of handling. You know, it's the kind of thing now that where the contention is that so far there are no rules that say if you go ATSC, it must be carried on the cable system. So that's still a bit up in the air. But as far as the cable viewer is concerned, if they do decide to carry an ATSC 3 in 4K or whatever happens to be on it, that will be through some negotiation, specifically per cable system and per broadcaster. But there's no rules that say you must and you have to do this yet, although we may see that change.
So for a cable viewer customer, the material is being sent to him on a particular RF carrier for that particular channel. The modulation itself is a 32 or 64 QAM, quad amplitude modulation, or in some cases low resolution 16 QAM, and that's likely to continue So it sounds to me like in the next few years, the cable viewer is not going to see much of a change. However, because there's a move toward 2K and 4K programming, right now, how many of the channels can I watch on my cable system? If I was a cable watcher, would I be getting in 1K, 2K, and 4K resolution? And is that likely to change in the next couple of years as broadcasters start emphasizing a lot more of 4K? And by the way, has anybody ever dreamed about 8K? K2EJ, K2LIW, the TechNet.
All right, just let me correct your nomenclature here for a minute. What you're calling 1K is actually standard definition of 525 line pictures. 2K is actually HD that you get now. That's 1080i, that's 30 hertz. The 1080p is 60 hertz, which we've done transmit over the air because it uses up every little bit of bandwidth and then some. And 4K, it's not really 4K, it's what we call Ultra HD or UHD, you'll see it labelized. 4K is used in cinema, which is really truly 4096, whereas UHD is 3780. I forget what the number is, something like that. The aspect ratio is slightly different. But the reality is that right now you receive 2K if you're watching HD. 4K can't go over the air unless it's being done by ATSC3, and the actual bit rate after that modulation scheme is around 32 megabits as opposed to 19.3 or 19.4 megabits. Let me let it drop.
Question.
What you're calling 8K, actually the NHK is now gearing up to do the Olympics in 8K, so it's going to be there. Nobody's going to be able to receive it. Interestingly enough, while we're on the subject of 4K or UHD, Ultra HD, NASA has a full-time channel on the satellite transmitting Ultra HD from the space station. There's another station in there, you can pick them up. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Before we leave the subject, Erica, right now, the average cable TV watcher is looking at how many channels of what resolution, and is that likely to change in the next couple of years? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, you're asking a question that should be asked of a cable operator. How many channels of what resolution? You know, how many channels of the standard definition, and how many channels of high definition, and how many channels of Ultra HD? Right now, Dish Network, DirecTV, and I believe Altice, I'm not sure about Time Warner or Spectrum and Comcast, how many UHD channels are running, but right now everybody seems to be running one ultra high def channel, and of course the only content they're providing are movies. So where that goes, I couldn't tell you. In terms of the number of channels, I mean, most cable companies will provide a standard definition, you know, a 525 line output of a particular broadcaster and an HD on two different channels. So, same thing with the satellites. You know, that way you can still plug into a legacy receiver, you know, and get a picture. As far as the number, there's, you know, if Channel 2 is transmitting HD, they're also being transmitted in SD. Interestingly enough, all the New York broadcasters, I can't tell you about any place else, we actually have two systems. One system provides standard definition for the standard definition outputs of the cable company, and we also provide a high definition output, which is fed to our transmitters and also to the cable companies. As far as how long that continues, the guess is it's going to be the next 20 years. And as far as like 8VSD going away, that's probably somewhere within the same 20-year time span. But it's not mandatory, that's just a guess. It's RWK2J.
Since
Repeater, timeout.
MC8PSB is going to be around for a while. Does that mean a serious watcher is going to be having two separate systems in his house? He's over the air watching, and he wants to watch both 8VSB as well as ATSC 3. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, here's a story about that. If, let's say, let's use New York, and New York decides that they're all going to start transmitting ATSC 3, they're still going to have to transmit their 8VSB. What they're going to do is they're going to get together and they're going to say, okay, we're going to use Channel 2's transmitter for all the SDs, and of course what they'll do is you won't see high def anymore, you'll see shrunk down standard definitions, so they can all pack them into one transmitter, and everybody else will have their ATSC 3 transmitted. The other side of the coin is if you're transmitting ATSC 3, you can also stuff those SD and HD pictures into the ATSC 3, so if you're in a place like New York where the receiver is going to pick up the ATSC 3, the receiver will also have an 8VSB receiver in it, which will handle the local stuff, and will also handle the people who aren't transmitting ATSC 3. So, for the serious watcher, he just needs to go out and buy a new set and throw the old one away.
And that new set will have built-in hardware, software, so that it gets both standards simultaneously, ATSC 3 and 8VSB. So the new set I'll be buying will have those two standards built into it.
Well, actually not three, Dick.
What will the third one be? I can't believe it's going to be old fashioned analog. NTSC, never twice the same. It's going to have all three standards, Eric. Go ahead.
Anybody going to transmit 3D?
That's correct, Dick. They're not going to drop the analog format because there's still an awful lot of VCRs and other types of gear out there that put out an output on channel 3 and it's amplitude modulated.
When I watch what is RF channel 3, which is advertised as channel 33, are you telling me that is NTSC? That's amplitude modulated, Eric? Go ahead.
No, if you're talking about WJLP, that's 8VSB. It just happened to be on channel 3, but if you ever bought a VCR, or you ever bought a security camera, or if you ever bought a DVD player, you notice that there's an RF jack. There's an S connector on them, and usually there's a switch that will let you switch between channel 3 and channel 4 in terms of its output, and those outputs are going to be analog. Oh, and by the way, there's still a few analog broadcasters, and there's a lot of internal cable systems and stuff like that. It's all analog, so it ain't going to go away that fast.
So the set I buy a year from now will have all three standards built into its front end. Fantastic. I know that Wes wanted to ask a question. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
I believe you gave the answer to the question. I was just kind of confused when I was thinking about asking you about QAM as it is present for analog modulation and for digital modulation at the same time. My question, my confusion came from the fact that you were talking about about the frequency signal on given frequency being presented to the fiber instead of being presented to the antenna. So I was. How should I understand? Okay, I have a signal that is ready to be transmitted out, and now I'm getting this signal and sending it through the fiber. And that signal is also told by you guys is quite a choppy to modulation. And also, it is in digital as it is in analog. So that was my confusion. Network share.
I think I see the question that Wes is asking. And Eric, let me word it my way, and maybe you can answer both. In the case of a fiber optic cable, in order to be able to have a cable system receiver in my house that's receiving something from the fiber, is the fiber optical signal being modulated at an RF rate? Are there really different RF frequencies of optical modulation going over that cable? Is that how my box in my house is selecting which channel I see? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, that's a cool question. There's a couple different ways that they do it, but pretty much the standard way that Fios and a few others do it is they will take a piece of cable that has signals in it running from 54 megahertz to a gig, and they will take that, and that will be the actual modulation. It'll essentially, we will turn a laser on and off at the rate at which that stuff is coming in. So in essence, when you take the photo detector and you look at the output, you need a spectrum analyzer to see what's at 54 megahertz through 1 gigahertz. So yeah, it's real RF. We do the same thing with our satellite feed. We don't run satellites through RG6 anymore. I mean, I've got 1,000 feet between me and the dish. That's 33rd Street. We've got 12 or 1,400 feet. And what we do is we run a piece of fiber up to the LMB. And actually, the LMBs these days, which should not be this way, but the LMB has a fiber spigot port on it, on the newest ones. But you would generally take that IF, which is 900 megahertz to 1.4 gig, you stuff that into this box, it in turn modulates that in light, and then you bring it down to the other end, and you demodulate the light back to baseband. The baseband happens to start at 900 megahertz.
I can envision a cable system that wants to carry a whole lot of information, high def, super high def, and whatever, where they might want to go beyond 54 megahertz to 1 gig. There are cable television, there are optical cable standards. One of those standards goes to 10 gigabits per second, one of them goes to 40 gigabits per second. So in theory, They could carry 54 megs to 2 gigs, for instance. Do they all stop at exactly 1 gig, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, actually they don't. I've seen stuff that runs up to 3 gigs baseband. So that's newer. I mean, the problem here is, think about all the problems that you have over the air. Now, when you're going through the fiber medium, that stuff is no longer an issue because you have a constant medium that you're passing the stuff through. So, if, say, you need to equalize it, it becomes pretty much a fixed kind of thing. Although, that's when you're talking about a cable system, you're talking about hundreds of miles of path. And don't forget, the way that we amplify light is a whole different game than what we do with coax. But the limiting factors here are being able to turn the laser diode on and off fast enough. In the beginning of using light for communications, we started out by using mechanical devices to create the modulation. An acoustic wave surface, like a crystal that physically moves, that you can move in the hundreds of thousands of megahertz region. That's how we began. But you got to remember, there's a certain period of time that it takes for a laser to start, and there's a certain period of time where the slew rates of the photodiode begin to get in the way, and you wind up with the equivalent of some of the stuff that you have in transmission called differential phase, group delay, things of that nature. So the limiting factors really are just the technology of the emitters and the detectors.
When it comes to the optical transmitter that puts the signal onto the cable, your wording led me to believe that you're really turning the laser on and off that fast. Is that the way it's only done, as opposed to putting a Bragg cell modulator, or in other words, having a CW laser and something that has a variable attenuator, a modulator after the laser, or maybe a combination of the two? Bragg cell is one way I can think of doing it, but there's a lot of other ways. What's the most popular technique for putting the signal onto the cable? Is it really the laser that's modulated, or is it a modulator after the laser? KE2EJ, K2IW.
All right, the most popular method, or at least the one that's currently being used, you got to remember this, the turn-on time. So, rather than turn the laser off completely, we create a bias level, a minimum level that laser emits at. And once we've achieved that minimum level, it's like, think of it like a plasma screen, where you got to get to a certain voltage before the gas begins to conduct. Well, it's sort of the same sort of idea in the lasers, that we're going to provide enough bias current to make that thing laser all the time, then what we're going to do is increase the amplitude and decrease the amplitude at whatever rate, whatever slew rate is going to be required for the bandwidth that you're doing. One method. There's another method, which is after the continuous laser source, where it is essentially, if you want to think of it like the Texas Instruments DMD mirrors, where you have a surface where you change the angle of the surface, and you have a target hole, you have a little pinhole in which, when it's not interrupting or deflecting the light, it passes through that pinhole and moves into the fiber. When that reflective device changes its pitch slightly, it misses the hole, and that you would consider that to be a zero. And actually, there are some systems which it looks like a V, so that way it gives you an amplitude change along with, say, 1 and 0, K2RWK2J. And there's a few more methods.
I'm guessing the lasers that do the transmitting into a fiber optic cable these days are primarily solid state. In which case, you have a certain bias current going into it.
They're always solid state.
Okay, so vacuum tube type lasers are essentially obsolete these days. I can see a bunch of reasons why. Roughly how many watts are they running? Must be a very expensive device. I'm guessing the voltage you apply versus the illumination you get out of it is a very nonlinear curve. Therefore, pre-distortion is probably required in order to force it into linearity. But how many watts are these solid state lasers that are putting that fiber optic signal onto that cable? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Don't forget, you've got amplifiers, and the loss through fiber is nothing like what the loss through coax is. I've never seen a laser more than in that application, greater than a watt. I'm sure there are, but there's no reason.
Okay, so it's approximately a 1 watt laser. A real good piece of fiber, I'm guessing, has a fraction of a decibel of loss per kilometer. And every, I'm going to pick a number, 30 kilometers, you've got an optical amplifier. You no longer have to demodulate to RF, amplify, and then remodulate back to video, back to optical. So you've got optical amplifiers these days. And what was I going to ask you? So roughly a watt. And my guess is they're getting some very nice life and probably reasonable efficiency out of these things, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW. Maybe not even very expensive.
Actually, they're not really expensive. I mean, you know, the cost of a cable front end is pretty much the same as it was when it was coax. Actually, I think some of this stuff is even cheaper these days. But one thing that you're forgetting, you start thinking in three dimensions. All these systems use wave division multiplication, meaning We use different color lights for different services, so the amount of bandwidth required in any one service, the stage